timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut. Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Well, it is Saturday, the 1st of April in the glorious future year of 2023, and I'm still recovering from whatever it was that I was suffering from. But, you know, I think I can do the show, so that's the important part. Now, it is the 1st of April, and I was considering doing an April Fool's episode. But, you know what? I just can't. Because I would have to find something more backward and absurd than the things that are actually going on in the world right now. I mean, you look at my home country, the United States of America, where in many states they're behaving as though the most crucial political issue that they have right at the moment is the imposition of sumptuary laws from the 18th century to regulate what categories of people are permitted to wear what styles of clothing. Really, I thought we had left that kind of thing behind a long time ago. And of course, making laws that prohibit the performance of Shakespeare's plays. You know, of course, if you know anything about the subject, that when Shakespeare's plays were first staged, all actors were men. That the men's roles and the women's roles were all played by men, or boys. Pretty much the only thing that wasn't played by a man was the bear in the famous Exeunt Pursued by Bear, which, as it turns out, was probably a polar bear cub that had been brought back by an expedition to Greenland and was being exhibited nearby as a attraction. Anyway, so the result, of course, is that in his comedies, Shakespeare plays with this enormously, and you'd be hard-pressed to find one of them where there aren't boys dressed as girls dressed as boys dressed as girls dressed as boys, and so on. Somehow our all-wise legislators have come to the conclusion that this is the key question which will determine the fate of a great nation. You know, there are so many really important things going on that care needs to be taken about, but they're not interested in doing anything about any of them. Instead, they're making up completely imaginary political questions purely, as it seems, for the purpose of distracting folks from the fact that they're not doing the things that really desperately need to be done. And to me, that is, I mean, it's offensive, it's criminal. I don't know why people put up with it. Having your prejudices catered to is not a good enough reason to support such idiocy as this. Of course, I have a very low tolerance for idiocy. Pardon me for the unavoidable nasty biological noises every now and then. Speaking of idiocy, of course, saw a piece in the German publication Die Welt the other day, in which a politician from one of the parties not in the coalition government was complaining, saying Germans seem to think that climate action is only valuable if it hurts. And this is not an unreasonable complaint. But I went and looked at what she was saying, and she said, well, you know, we've been subsidizing buying battery electric cars to the tune of about 20,000 euros, which it's been calculated works out to 800 euros per ton of saved carbon dioxide emissions. Whereas, of course, on the European emissions exchange right now, it's only $80 per ton. So wouldn't we have been better off just to buy up all the emissions credits on the European emissions exchange? There are, of course, several problems with this concept. A very obvious one, of course, is that if you're subsidizing battery electric cars, well, those subsidies are certainly going to be more effective if your electricity mix is about 20 grams of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour, as in France, rather than 400 grams, as it is in Germany. It's also certainly true that if you're going to be subsidizing battery electric cars, those subsidies can be a great deal smaller if your electricity price is 10 or 15 or even 20 cents per kilowatt hour, as it might be in France, rather than 50 cents per kilowatt hour, plus 20% consumption tax, which it is for residential customers in Germany. And yes, I was just looking at the electricity bill of my hosts here in Munich. That's the kind of electricity price which makes even the prices associated with Hinkley Point C, or Vogtle 3 and 4, the most costly nuclear projects pretty much in the world ever, to actually be, you know, finished. I don't count ones that were abandoned partway through. That's the kind of price that makes those projects look attractive. But it should be obvious to anyone that there are cheaper ways to reduce transit sector emissions. The politician in question was saying, well, transit sector emissions are some of the most difficult to reduce. And then giving this electric car example, to which I say it should be obvious to anyone that there are other ways, and frequently cheaper ways, and frequently quicker and more expeditious ways to reduce transit sector emissions than by paying people to buy battery electric cars. Discouraging car trips. Well, I say discouraging. I shouldn't say discouraging. It's not what I mean. What I mean is giving people a good alternative so that they won't take car trips. See? That's the key. So beginning next month, the 49 euro ticket comes into force, which will cover for all basically local services in Germany. It doesn't cover the ICE trains, the high-speed trains, and I'm not clear on whether it covers the IC trains, the sort of conventional intercity trains. But it covers everything else. U-bonds and S-bonds and all those kinds of things. And although it's been criticized quite reasonably on the grounds that it doesn't provide for a good continuing funding mechanism for the public transportation systems, nevertheless, if it's successful, I mean, last summer they experimented with this. If it's successful in reducing the number of car trips, it's probably a much cheaper way of reducing transit sector emissions than trying to get everybody to buy a battery electric car. Similar, she was saying, you know, basically various things about how, you know, we ought to be building, you know, atmosphere doesn't care where a kilogram of carbon dioxide is emitted, which is true enough, and then saying we should be investing in projects that reduce emissions in other countries because the cost of reducing emissions in Germany is uncommonly high, you know, because we don't have all that much sunshine, whatever. You know, to which I say, yes and no. I mean, there are some very inexpensive things that Germany could do to reduce emissions, or at least avoid emissions increases, because keeping your nuclear power plants running doesn't cost much of anything at all. In fact, normally it's a pretty profitable thing to do, as judged by just how many life extension projects there have been. So this idea that reducing emissions is always more expensive in Germany doesn't necessarily hold water. Meanwhile, of course, there's all kinds of controversy over what really constitutes an green investment, an emissions-reducing investment, etc., etc., etc. From my point of view, obviously, there are a lot of things that are questionable. And when I see somebody saying, well, we'll just, you know, buy carbon credits on the exchange, you know, I continue to question just exactly how good are the accounting ground rules, how good is the auditing, etc., how meaningful are those kilograms? Because, to be frank, they may not be very meaningful. And this is very different, as I say, from the field of atomic energy, where things are very much measured and quantified and traced. There was a bit of a brouhaha a few weeks back because there was a discharge of tritiated water from the Monticello nuclear power plant in Minnesota, and people are saying, oh my god, it's discharging radioactive water. Well, I happened to look at what the figures were. Now, the maximum figure permitted by the EPA for tritium, that's radioactive hydrogen, a low-energy beta emitter with a half-life of 12 years, tritium in water, drinking water specifically, is measured in picocuries per liter. And, well, a curie is 37 times 10 to the 9th power disintegrations per second. So a picocurie being 10 to the negative 12th power times that is less than 1 disintegration per second. So the EPA standard involves quantities less than 1 disintegration per second per liter. Anyway, seems a trifle confusing. So someone was saying, oh, well, they measured quantities as high as 5 million picocuries per liter. And so I said, well, let's cast this into a somewhat more reasonable frame of reference. So 5 million picocuries per liter is 5 microcuries per liter, assuming I haven't done my arithmetic wrong. 5 microcuries per liter, okay. That's the equivalent, of course, a smoke detector typically contains a 1 microcurie source. So 5 microcuries per liter sounds like it might be a lot. What can we compare it to? So then I said, well, I just so happen to have, I was recently saw online where a guy was talking about how he'd had a cardiac stress test done in the New York City area. And they gave him a little card to show to the cops, because as it turns out, if you've had a cardiac stress test or some other diagnostic procedure with radioactive substances, you are, of course, radioactive to an extent which may be detected externally, and the New York City cops, and presumably many other major city police forces, have sensitive enough detectors in their cars that if you are walking down the street and they're driving along, they can detect you, they will pull over, pile out of the car, hold you at gunpoint, and demand to know why you're radioactive and are you doing a nuclear terrorism. And so then you pull the card out of your wallet and it explains that you received, and this particular guy's card showed that he had received 35 microcuries of, no, sorry, 35 millicuries. 35 millicuries, or a millicurie is of course 1,000 microcuries. 35 millicuries of technetium-99m. Now, avoiding not accounting for the fact that the energy of technetium-99m is much greater than the decay energy of tritium, just looking at it this way, 35 millicuries is if the most contaminated water was 5 microcuries per liter, 35 millicuries is the equivalent of 7,000 liters of that most contaminated water. Now, you'd have to drink 7,000 liters of that water in order to receive, in order to have in your body the same amount of radioactivity that's given in a simple medical test. But of course you can't have 7,000 liters of water in your body. Your body isn't that big. If you tried to drink 7,000 liters of water, it would take you something like 2 years, right? Because you're talking about, that's, you know, at 10 liters a day, it would take you about 2 years. And 10 liters a day, that's a lot of water to drink. If you've ever tried to measure the amount you drink in a course of a day, 5 is more typical. 10 is a lot. You try to drink much more than 10 liters a day, you can injure yourself quite badly, in fact. So the fact is that what would really happen is that for the course of 2 years, you would have in your body continuously a quantity of tritium considerably less than 35 millicuries. Now, obviously, you shouldn't necessarily have in your body all the time the amount of radioactive material that's administered for a cardiac stress test. Right. That's sort of a one-and-done deal. It passes out in a couple of days. But still, it just fascinated me. Again, quantitative thinking is something that I kind of do as a default action. A lot of people don't do it at all. A lot of people are very, very uncomfortable with quantitative thinking and with the kinds of conclusions that come from it. And then, of course, you have people who are trying to present as conclusions from quantitative thinking absolute nonsense or even kind of horrible stuff that they have made up. And so I can understand why people would be suspicious of it in that context. Anyway, but I was reading a thing online, and someone was talking, and apparently a sincere, and good-hearted person with, some decent education, enough for a PhD or what have you, maybe even a professor, was saying that we're going to have to change the form of our society in order to account, because the future society will have to be shaped by Earth system limits. Now again, this is not dissimilar to what the German politician was saying in her article, because she was pointing out that there was a fairly well-known German writer, an editor of the TAZ named Ulrike Hermann, who wrote a bestseller called The End of Capitalism, basically saying there's all kinds of things we can't have anymore because they will overburden the Earth system. Well, here's the thing. When anybody says things have to be exactly this way because of the limits of the Earth system, it's worth inquiring what limits are you talking about and what context are you interpreting them in. Because here's the thing. In the Paleolithic, in the Old Stone Age, 50,000 years ago or so, what was the Earth system limit? What was the population of woolly mammoths? A statistician of the Paleolithic period could very easily have calculated, and this is a rough figure, but I'm sure there's someone who can correct me, could very easily have calculated that Europe could support no more than about 100 bands of 250 humans each, because any more than that, they would be killing woolly mammoths faster than the woolly mammoths reproduced, and the population would collapse, their food supply would implode, and everybody would just die. Now, it is a fascinating observation that today, Europe supports 20,000 times 25,000 humans, and not a single woolly mammoth in sight. Not one on the entire continent. Isn't that fascinating? Was there any error in the Ice Age statistician's calculation? No! No, they're absolutely correct within those terms of reference. But the terms of reference of the future may be so different from those of today. The world of the future may be as different from the world that we are living in now as the world, our world, of cities and electrification is from the world of the Ice Age Mammoth Hunter. What are the relevant Earth system limits? What are they? An obvious one would be thermodynamic, right? There are various limitations that we can envision based on having to obtain minerals from seawater or country rock, that sort of thing. If you've followed my supplementary shows, I read a couple of pieces by Alvin Weinberg about burning the seas and burning the rocks, talking about energy as an ultimate raw material and about where we get energy in a long-term state where all the rich ores have been consumed. I mean, that's an interesting question, right? What are the relevant Earth system limits? Because, of course, if our civilization extends beyond Earth, then sometimes we can just ignore the Earth system limits. I mean, people have talked very sort of vaguely about constructing big occulting disks, which would block out disks in orbit of the sun, which would block out part of the sunlight falling on the Earth so as to mitigate global warming. Now, this sounds like an idea which is simultaneously grandiose and stupid. It's probably still better than the idea some people have had of stimulating volcanic eruptions or otherwise filling the upper atmosphere with sulfur dioxide particulates, which have proven extremely effective in blocking out sunlight and lowering global temperature, right? The Year Without a Summer, which inspired the creation of the novel Frankenstein, that was largely due to volcanic ash and sulfur dioxide in the upper atmosphere. Other people may remember more recently, when I was a kid, of course there was Mount St. Helens, but there's also the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. So, if I had to take a choice between people proposing to inject sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere to reduce the amount of sunlight that's falling on the Earth, increase the amount that's reflected directly to space, or the possibility of someone trying to construct an enormous disk in space in order to block out a part of the sunlight falling on the Earth, I would naturally choose the second option. Firstly, because I would expect that it would be much easier to clean up if we decided we didn't want it, right? Just sort of move it out of the way. And secondly, because it would require developing the capability to do big things in space. And the more we can do big things in space, that is to say, not on Earth, the less we have to do them on Earth, which means the less relevant Earth system limits are. And, of course, the magnification of that is if many, many people are living off Earth, they are, by definition, not included within the Earth system limits. If we establish biospheres, more... pardon me. If we establish biospheres, right, more or less self-sustaining artificial biospheres in places other than the Earth, then for the people and animals and plants in those biospheres, Earth system limits are, by definition, less relevant, right? So to an extent, so far as we wish to preserve the Earth and its natural systems and respect the limits of those natural systems, we should be considering doing stuff that has a tendency to burden those systems someplace else. This isn't exactly wacky talk here. But it's a thing to think about. So yeah, Earth system limits. Anytime somebody tells you, well, the future will have to look like X and not like Y because of Earth system limits, it's very likely that their perspective is too narrow, and you should bear that in account when evaluating the other things that they say. Because people have a habit of saying things that, to a great extent, reflect their preconceptions. I'm not saying that I necessarily want capitalism to continue forever, right? But saying, oh, well, capitalism will stop because of natural forces. Well, it's a cop-out at first. It has the same problem as Marx's doctrine of historical inevitability, which is you try something and it doesn't work, you say, oh, well, the material conditions weren't right. But they'll be right eventually. I don't have to be morally responsible for what I do, because it's all the result of forces beyond my control. Thing is, sometimes things really are the result of forces beyond your control, but when your mindset is automatically to look for that, it leads to a kind of passivity and despair, which has the result that you will very likely never really solve your problems. This is why Landauer, the great Bavarian socialist, was so strongly anti-Marxist. He said, you must start building the institutions that you want to have after the revolution before the revolution, or you will never get them. Both he and Chesterton and Belloc, the English distributists, and various others pointed out that the whole Marxist concept implies that the revolution happens when the proletariat is at its most demoralized, most incapable of action, which is why everything has to be done for them by the Revolutionary Vanguard Party, which takes over the apparatus of the bourgeois capitalist state when it has reached its peak of being most absolutely oppressive and intolerable. And somehow, the fact that the Revolutionary Vanguard Party takes it over makes everything beautiful and wonderful. Even though nothing in the material conditions has actually changed, it's still the same apparatus of oppression being run by someone who is, you know, outside the proletariat. It's just, in this case, it's the Revolutionary Vanguard Party and not the bourgeois capitalists. And this, Marx calls a dictatorship of the proletariat. Well, we see what it actually turns out to be in practice with the rise of the Russian Revolution, right? Lenin's dictatorship of the proletariat was indistinguishable from any other kind of dictatorship. He didn't abolish the Cheka, the Tsar's secret police, he actually made it worse. Lenin's Russia was actually more oppressive than the Tsar's Russia, a thing no one had thought possible. So yes, I want you all to be hopeful for the future rather than despairing, because it is only people who are hopeful, who are not demoralized, who can act and make something worth being hopeful about out of the future. That's all I have to say. You've been listening to A Step Farther Out on Anon Radio. Write cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, USA.